Welcome to the Cancer Care Connect workshop. At this time, all participants are in a listen-only mode. Later, we will conduct a question-and-answer session, and instructions will follow at that time. If anyone should require assistance during the workshop, please press star then zero on your touch-tone telephone. As a reminder, this workshop is being recorded. At this time, I would like to introduce your moderator for today's workshop, Dr. Carolyn Messner, Director of Education and Training at Cancer Care. Please go ahead.
Well, thank you very much, Stephanie, and I too would like to welcome everyone to today's program. Today is a part of a six-part series, Living with Myeloproliferative Neoplasms, and today's program really focuses upon really interesting topics of the role of exercise, meditation, and nutrition, all of which are very important modalities in terms of coping with myeloproliferative neoplasms. And we have wonderful speakers today. And I also want to acknowledge that we have wonderful collaborating organizations on today's program. And we have a number of cancer organizations that are collaborating to make this program possible, to spread the word. And we also have the MPN Education Foundation and MPN Research Foundation as well, also helping us to really help spread the word about the program. And it's because of all of this work together that we've been able to reach so many of you on the call today. So today we have on the call over 682 participants. So you come from all over the United States, from all parts of the U.S., and we also have international participants today from Australia, Canada, Iran, Morocco, Mexico, Spain, United Kingdom, and Venezuela. So it really is a credit to all of you that you've chosen to spend the next hour with us. I'd like to turn your attention for a moment to the materials you received from Cancer Care. In those materials is information about all the different collaborating organizations as a resource for you to use. They're free resources for you to contact and call. There also is information about our speakers and the topics they'll be addressing. And there also is an evaluation form. And I would ask you all to take a moment and complete that evaluation form. When you think about it, you are the best people to tell us the topics you'd like us to offer going forward. And we are planning many programs in this 2014 year. We are at the beginning of the year to some extent, and we're planning many things. And this particular series was one that many of you have asked us to do. And so here it is. And we very much encourage you to tell us what you'd like us to do, and we'll try very hard to implement your suggestions. Today's program was made possible by the Insight Corporation. I really want to thank them not only for today's program, but for this entire six-part series, which really has been going on now for it's a six-month program, and it's really been wonderful. This is part three. And we have wonderful speakers on our program today, and I want to begin by introducing our first speaker. And our first speaker is Dr. Jason Gottlieb. And Dr. Gottlieb is Associate Professor of Medicine, Hematology, Director, Stanford MPN Center, Stanford University School of Medicine, Stanford Cancer Institute. And Dr. Gottlieb is going to address an overview of myeloproliferative neoplasms and weight changes, causes of your weight loss or gain, and communicating with your healthcare team, and particularly around strategies for managing your weight. It's my pleasure now to turn this program over to Dr. Gottlieb.
Carolyn, thank you very much, and it really is a privilege to be able to share this hour with patients living with MPNs and their families and other caregivers. And as Carolyn just alluded to, my task over perhaps the next 10 minutes is to provide individuals on this call a brief overview of myeloproliferative neoplasms, or MPNs. And in that regard, I'm going to focus on myelofibrosis because in that specific type of MPN, which I will describe, there is a large issue with regard to progressive disease and issues of weight loss. So to start with MPNs, when we think about some of the so-called classic myeloproliferative neoplasms, we think of three conditions called polycythemia vera, essential thrombocythemia, and primary myelofibrosis. And polycythemia vera, just briefly, is a condition where there are too many red blood cells that are made and patients are at a risk of increasing chance of blood clots. Essential thrombocythemia, too many platelets are made, and platelets are cells that help clot the blood, and these patients also have an increased risk of blood clots or perhaps even bleeding. Now, the MPN that I like to focus on is called primary myelofibrosis, and this is a condition, a type of MPN, where there is an abnormal type of blood cell that's made within the bone marrow. And over time, these patients develop more and more of these abnormal blood cells within the bone marrow. And these abnormal blood cells are sensed by the bone marrow in the body as being abnormal. in response to that, the body produces a lot of inflammatory chemicals, or what we refer to as inflammatory cytokines. And I'll talk to this point in just a moment about what that causes in patients' bodies. But one of the things that happens within the bone marrow in response to these abnormal cells that are being made in the bone marrow is that because of all these inflammatory cytokines, the bone marrow's over time, usually over years, develops more and more scar tissue, or referred to as bone marrow fibrosis. And that is what gives the name the condition myelofibrosis. Now, because the bone marrow is responsible for making blood cells that eventually leave the bone marrow, go into the blood, and these are your white blood cells, which fight infection, the red blood cells that carry oxygen to make you feel strong, and platelets, which help clot the blood so you don't bleed, the bone marrow, which is eventually replaced more and more by the scar tissue, is unable to make these blood cells. And thus, over time, the patient can develop worsening blood counts, such as more and more anemia, such that patients feel more tired and short of breath, and decreased platelets, such that they may run into issues with bleeding or bruising. And they also may be predisposed to more and more infections. So the body senses this bone marrow that's become more and more scarred and tries to come up with a way to make more blood cells. So what it does is the body tries to find another organ which can make blood. And thus, this is where the spleen comes in. So the spleen is an organ which is in the upper left part of the abdomen, really tucked below the rib cage. And the spleen, actually, when one is in the uterus of a developing fetus, is the organ which makes the blood. And when you become, born and out of the womb, blood formation then goes back to the bone marrow. But the spleen gets bigger and bigger over time in myelofibrosis because it's trying to compensate for a bone marrow that's not working very well. And in addition, the spleen is a filtering organ of the blood. So it's not only trying to make more blood because the bone marrow is not working, but it's filtering the abnormal blood that's made in this condition, myelofibrosis. So patients over time develop a bigger and bigger spleen. So that's one fundamental feature of myelofibrosis, is a bigger and bigger spleen over time as the disease progresses, and a bone marrow that's not working very well. And a third feature is that patients develop progressive cachexia, or wasting. They lose weight, they have a big spleen, their bone marrow is not working. And this is a condition where patients become progressively more and more debilitated and lose weight and feel poorly. So let me then refer to this issue about what are the causes of weight loss. I think the audience can easily appreciate that if the spleen gets bigger and bigger, then patients may have more and more abdominal discomfort or pain, and they develop what we call early satiety. They get full very easily. In part, that's because the spleen becomes so big that it begins to push on the stomach, and people quickly lose their appetite or they get full very easily. And Dr. Mesa and colleagues actually did a survey of some 96 patients with myelofibrosis. And over time, weight loss was noted in about 50% of patients. Abdominal discomfort was noted in about 70% of patients. Early satiety, or early fullness, that is, was identified in 80% of patients. And fatigue was identified in basically 100% of patients. So this is a real problem with patients with fibrosis. Now, I also referred previously to this issue of these inflammatory chemicals that are produced by the body in response to these abnormal cells in the bone marrow. These are chemicals, or what I refer to as cytokines, that circulate throughout the body. And these are responsible for actually breaking down muscle, for loss of appetite, and just the general poor feeling that patients have when this disease progresses. Now, the other feature we see in these conditions is not only weight loss, but decreases in cholesterol. And patients may feel that, well, decreased cholesterol is a good thing because we associate decreased cholesterol with better cardiovascular health. But in fact, when the cholesterol goes very, very low, that's actually a marker of poor health and malnutrition. And this is what we see in patients with myelofibrosis. The cholesterol levels and the weight are very, very low. Now, on the other hand, I would say that weight gain would be an uncommon finding in patients with progressive myelofibrosis. I suspect that perhaps one reason that there could be weight gain in the few patients that have it is that sometimes the liver or spleen becomes so big that there's not normal flow of blood within the abdomen. And this can actually lead to what we call portal hypertension and actually worsening liver disease or cirrhosis. And patients can develop increasing fluid within the abdomen, which we refer to as ascites. And more fluid in the abdomen can actually contribute to weight gain, but that's not a healthy weight gain. And the other way that patients can develop weight gain, which I would again consider not to be good or normal, would be the development of fluid in the legs or other parts of the body because the kidneys are not working well, the heart is not pumping well, or the liver is not working. And we use a medical term edema for this. And again, this is where there is abnormal fluid gain, and this is not healthy muscle mass gain in these patients. Now, what are some of the strategies to manage your weight if you're a patient in particular with one of these MPNs that is myelofibrosis? Well, I mentioned that the spleen is very big, and if someone is having a fairly decent-sized meal, you can imagine that patients can get full very easily. So one of the strategies to improve this issue of weight loss and getting full easily is actually to have small, frequent meals throughout the day instead of having perhaps three large meals. One can consider having 4 to 6 small meals throughout the day to try to get the calories in. Another strategy that's been used is to use appetite stimulants, and they have been used with some modest success in patients, for example, with myelofibrosis. And one drug that comes to mind is a drug called Megase. It's a pill that can actually stimulate appetite. Another strategy would be to use supplements in addition to the meals, and they go by names such as Boost or Ensure. And these are taken, for example, 3 times a day with meals or in between meals to try to get more calories or protein in. And there are different types of supplements that have different calorie levels or protein levels to try to supplement perhaps loss of weight and the need to get in more protein or calories. Now, last portion of my talk here, I want to talk about drug therapy. And there are new groups of drugs called JAK inhibitors that are in trials, and one JAK inhibitor is approved called ruxolitinib, and it goes by the name brand Jakafi. And I bring this up because this is an agent that is now approved in the United States and Europe and other countries for the past 2.5 years. And this is a drug that actually has been shown to improve the metabolic status or the nutritional status of patients with myelofibrosis. So let me just spend one or 2 minutes talking about some of the data regarding some of the mature studies with this drug. There was a study called Comfort 1, which actually randomized patients with myelofibrosis to the ruxolitinib drug, Jakafi, or placebo. And in this study, the mean or average total cholesterol was low in both groups, the placebo group and the Jakafi-treated patients. About 80% of patients in both groups had a cholesterol that was below the lower limit of normal. Again, low cholesterol being a marker of poor health or malnutrition. 25% of patients in the with myelofibrosis had a body mass index which was below normal. Now, when you look at patients who were treated with ruxolitinib drug, 96% of the patients had a weight gain, and the average weight gain was about 12 to 13 pounds. 97% of the patients actually had an increase in total cholesterol. So that was also encouraging, and the average increase in cholesterol was about 40%. And again, the increase in cholesterol was from a level that was too low, and the increase was not above the upper limit of normal that we would see for healthy patients. Now, the other last interesting point about these data was the following. Among patients who were treated with ruxolitinib who actually had a weight gain that was higher than the average seen in the study, that was actually associated with a relatively prolonged survival compared to those who had an average weight gain. And similarly, if patients had an increase in total cholesterol that was above the average seen amongst all patients in the study, that was associated with a prolonged survival compared to the average amount of cholesterol gained amongst all patients in the study. So these are encouraging data. It shows that use of a JAK inhibitor in patients with myelofibrosis can be associated with reversal of the weight loss, improvement of the poor cholesterol, and these are factors that really impact quality of life in patients with myelofibrosis. So I think I'd like to stop there, and I can certainly, in the questioning portion of the session, go back and I'd be glad to answer the questions from the audience members. Thank you very much.
Well, thank you very much, Dr. Gottlieb. That was really excellent and quite outstanding overview, and really issues around weight, the issues of weight and how to manage them. It really is very helpful. Thank you very much. And our next speaker, and I know there will be questions for you during the Q&A as well. Thank you. And our next speaker is Donna Wilson. Ms. Wilson is actually a pulmonary clinical nurse specialist, fitness coordinator, Integrative Medicine Center, Memorial Sloan Kettering Cancer Center. And she will address the benefits of physical activity. And it's my pleasure now to turn this program over to Donna Wilson.
Hello, everyone. Thank you very much for inviting me today. I think I'm going to start off knowing about this type of disease and this type of cancer is that I want to say that exercise is medicine. I think that as soon as we get this plan, you get this treatment, you get your treatment plan, at the time of diagnosis, you really should be getting a plan of exercise, knowing that the weight loss and all the problems that exist there. So right away, so you don't fall behind, is really to keep the muscles as best you can. And to be honest with you, I'm trying to motivate you because I think that there are times that you feel so tired that you don't want to exercise, but it is absolutely most important. So I think the most important thing is when you would hope that your healthcare team is going to start you on an exercise program. It doesn't have to be anything in the gym either. It could be something that we could do right at home. But the most important is to confirm what your blood counts are, so to make sure that it is safe that you can exercise. And it's also to make sure that I want you to have a program that would be safe and effective, enjoyable, and also take into account any physical limitations that you do have. In the American Cancer Society and the American guidelines of the American Sports Medicine, they have come up with guidelines for all cancer patients. And we really want patients to start at the time of diagnosis and not wait until at the end of treatment or when they're starting to really say, gee, I'm so weak, I don't know what else to do. So it's important to think about how physical activity is related to your health. You want to maintain your healthy bones, muscles, joints, and also by movement, you're going to improve your flexibility. You will decrease your fatigue. We've noticed from all of the projects that we've done is that when people exercise during a treatment, their actual fatigue level is less than someone that does not exercise. And also from a psychological standpoint, it does decrease your stress level and it improves, you know, it will decrease your anxiety and depression. So it's most important. Now, what kind of evidence is there supporting the benefits of exercise? Well, we know that it is safe. From all perspectives, all types of cancer, we know that exercise is safe. We know that aerobic fitness is safe. And when we say aerobic fitness, I don't want people to get overwhelmed and say, oh, my gosh, I don't run, you know, I'm not a jogger, I don't do steroids. But you know what? You can walk or you can increase your rate of walking, like you can walk really slow it for one block and then faster to the next block. You could incorporate stair climbing, and actually coordinating your pattern of breathing with the stair climbing will make it, because when you do stair climbing, you're using all your large muscle groups, and that's what you really want to maintain, those large muscle groups of your legs and your buttocks and your lower back. So the thing is, when you go up a step, I'll tell you now, is you breathe out with each step so that you will not get so fatigued, because every muscle contraction that you do in your body takes oxygen. So it's very, very important that you coordinate your pattern of breathing with each exercise. Muscular strength, you can start off using elastic bands or just two bottles of water, a pint size of water weighs a pound and a half. You could start that way and work yourself up. And you want to, again, if you're doing the weight training, you might want to just do it sitting in a chair. You want to support your back and to make sure that your core muscles, your stomach muscles, stay tight when you are exercising. When you're sitting in a chair, you also can do a lot of leg lifts, just contracting the muscles of your thigh so that you really can maintain their strength. A very simple exercise, which actually a caregiver can help you do or somebody, you know, a friend can help you, is called a chair squat. It's an exercise where you sit you're sitting in a chair, you scooch forward in the chair, so your buttocks is in the middle of the chair, and you squeeze your buttocks, and you breathe out, and you lift up and down. You do 10 of those chair squats. It does increase your heart rate, so it's good from a cardiovascular standpoint, but it's maintaining the strength of those large muscle groups. Also flexibility, doing arm circles, doing leg circles, anything to sort of just move the body so it doesn't get so stiff. I did have a client just recently who told me that she lost all her muscles. And I said, no, they are there. They're just that they're just atrophied. And that's what you don't want. You don't want to get them so weak that you look like you're just with, you know, like a skeleton. You want to really maintain the muscle strength. And as the muscle gets stronger, it also improves the strength on the bone. As you feel stronger, it's going to improve your quality of life because you can do more activities of daily living. So I think just going over these kinds of things is really important. You want to feel better during treatment. We don't have to feel bad. We want to recover quicker from the treatment. Climbing stairs, which I mentioned, also improving your balance. You know, even if you have to start standing on one leg, holding onto a chair with one finger, just so your whole body weight is on one leg, will help increase the strength of that leg. And of course, I'm going to say it a few times, improving your self-image and having fun doing it. So when I say have fun doing it, maybe put some kind of music on that you really enjoy so that you can move to the music. So it's, you know, it almost inspires you. I think it's important that when you're doing some moderate exercise, think about trying to do it. I mean, my goal for anyone is trying to get them to move for 30 minutes 5 times a week. If you can only do 20, then you can maybe work up. And you don't have to do that 30 minutes or 20 minutes a day all in one time. Maybe you might do it 10 minutes 3 times a day or 20, you know, 15 minutes. But your ultimate goal is to build up that you would be able to do it three to five times a week. When you come to strength training, I think that, you know, start off slow. Say if you start off like with a 1 or a 2 pound weight and you have about 8 to 10 different strength training exercises, and they could be incorporating into doing a shoulder press, a bicep curl. You can do a triceps. You can do pullbacks where you squeeze the muscles of your back onto your spine. And you do 8 to 12 of those repetitions, and you want to do at least 2 sessions of those, 2 actual complete sets. And you try to do weight training anywhere from 2 to 3 times a week. When I talked a little bit about the flexibility of the large muscle groups, I want you to think about moving the arms and legs in a way that you feel the extension of them from the joint, so that you really, like when you stretch your arms out, you stretch them over to the side or over your head. If you want to bend over to stretch the muscles of the back, make sure there's a chair or you're by the bed so you can hold on if you have to. Also, there's something called, instead of static stretching, which we hold a stretch for like 30 seconds, sometimes dynamic stretching actually is more effective, where you take your arm and you just move it back and forth. So you're increasing the stretch and the flexibility of that muscle. And you can do that with your legs. You could be lying on the bed or on the floor or whatever, and lifting your legs up and down, doing circles with your legs. Again, maintaining flexibility and strength. So when I suggest exercises, as I mentioned before, I would also talk about the mini chair squats, just doing chair squats. Walking in place is many important. Say, well, I'm from the Northeast here, and the weather has been pretty dreadful, but then I tell all my clients to walk in the house. Look at the watch, look at a clock, and say, okay, I'm going to be walking continuously for 5 minutes. Then stop and do some knee lifts. And as you bring your knee up, you breathe out and coordinate the pattern of breathing. And you can, and as you breathe out, you tighten your stomach muscles. So not only are you working your legs, but you're working your abdominal muscles. You can do, you know, arm raises, or you can do bicep curls and leg raises. But again, always remember the power of your breath when you're lifting anything, like with an exercise, is when you're breathing out. So that will give you the strength to maintain the exercise. Always remember to breathe. I think when I do my exercise classes, I can't say that I probably say breathe out 100 times during the class, because I always see everybody trying to do the exercise but not really not breathing out. The breathing out, the more air you get out, the better air you get in. And the air you get back in is filled with oxygen. And that's what's going to be very important for you. There have been many, many exercise programs out there. Think about a program. If you need some supervised help, I'm sure you can find it. There might be someone in a physical therapy department or at a local gym or a person that has some training to assist you. And make sure you tell them what are your underlying problems. Make sure that when you do any weight training that you always do it in a sitting position, and because that's going to support your lower back. And so really, if you need something for your back to support it, that's important. If you need to do aerobic exercise to keep the joints as flexible as you can even get a little bike that's sort of just a sit. It attaches to a chair, and you can move your legs up and down. Do slow treadmill walking. You can use a resistance band. But the most important, and I can say this with really what doing this after 12 years of working with cancer survivors, is that I always see a dramatic change when one starts to exercise. And the things that I see that are so dramatic is that their fatigue level decreases, their mood improves, and they know it's safe. I always find it very fascinating when I start a class, people tend to be quite quiet. And by the end of the class, everybody's quite chatty. And I think it's because they feel good. They feel so much better by increasing the heart rate and getting that blood pumped around their body and feeling stronger and more efficient. So I think most important is that when you think about what your problems are, is that you want to have someone help you customize an exercise program. Again, most important, physician clearance. Make sure your blood values are okay. Make sure someone does an assessment of your flexibility and of your aerobic. They may test you aerobically or cardiovascularly by having you step up and down on a step and monitoring your heart rate. Flexibility training, muscle conditioning is most important, balance training, and, of course, stretching. I can't say enough that I really do believe that exercise is medicine. And I must admit that with all the research and all the things that I've done in the last many years, is I know it's safe at the beginning, during, and after treatment. And most importantly, always consider that you always want to keep doing a little bit more each week as you're doing your exercise program. I hope you enjoyed this, and if you have any questions, please ask me at the end. Thank you so much.
And thank you so much, Donna. That was really wonderful. And we're all going to carry that your message around in our heads and try to implement some of what you suggested, which is so important. So thank you, really. And I'm sure there'll be questions for you during the Q&A. Thank you. And our next speaker is Mr. Richard Dickens. Mr. Dickens is an oncology social worker. He's clinical supervisor and mind-body project coordinator at Cancer Care. And he will be addressing the role of meditation, how meditation may help you. And he'll also review with you all of the free psychosocial support services offered by Cancer Care, including support groups. It's my pleasure now to turn this program over to Mr. Dickens, who's really going to really focus a lot on how meditation may help you. Rick?
Hi, Caroline, and thank you very much for the introduction. It's a pleasure being here. Within the last 10 to 20 years, all major cancer centers have established integrative medicine departments, which can also be called complementary alternative medicine and include mind-body-spirit practices such as meditation, yoga, qigong, guided imagery, and other techniques. While the use of these practices is still relatively new in the West, most of them have a history going back thousands of years in Eastern medicine. These practices are called holistic medicine because they treat the whole person, mind, body, and spirit, and integrative medicine because they are practices that can be done in conjunction with standard treatments. I'm going to begin with breath, which Donna had mentioned the importance of that in exercise, and Dr. Gottlieb also had mentioned that the importance of breath, especially oxygen, in our red blood cells, which really rejuvenate or replenish and restore the body. So I'm going to begin with breath, which is also the cornerstone of meditation. Dr. Andrew Weil, one of the leaders in integrative medicine, said in a 2005 Time magazine cover article, "I have long promoted the benefits of working with the breath as the simplest, most efficient way of taking advantage of the mind-body connection to affect both physical and mental health. When we are under stress, we are hardwired to take shallow breaths from our chest to quickly get oxygen to help us move into the fight or flight mode. After we confront the crisis at hand, our bodies return to our natural breath. This is the sympathetic and parasympathetic nervous systems. But when we are in an extended or chronic state of crisis or worry, as can be the case when dealing with myeloproliferative neoplasms, we don't return to our natural belly breath and the steady flow of oxygen we need to calm our mind and maintain our bodies. This state is very important in helping us make serious decisions about treatment and health. A simple way to observe your breath is to put one hand on your chest and the other one on your abdomen with your thumb on your navel. While doing this, take three breaths. If the primary hand moving is on your chest, then you're taking shallow breaths and are not using your full abdomen. As I said, breath is the cornerstone of meditation. The practice of meditation is simply an exercise in quieting the mind to help us maintain balance or equanimity in a world that is always changing. It is in no way meant to put us to sleep or remove us from our concerns. Quite the contrary, meditation actually heightens our awareness and helps us focus better. Walks in nature, repetitive prayer, listening to soothing music or ambient sounds are meditative techniques that most people engage in at some time or other. There are many types of meditation practices. One well-known type uses a mantra or sound as the point of focus, sometimes referred to as a one-pointed meditation. Transcendental meditation, or TM, is one of the most well-known of this type of practice. In TM, you sit quietly 20 minutes a day and focus on your mantra. When you notice the mind has wandered, you gently bring it back to the breath. The goal of this type of meditation is to transcend from a state of too much thought to no thought. If you study TM, you are given a Sanskrit word as a mantra. But you can also engage in this type of practice by using affirming one-syllable words such as peace, love, joy, and hope. Now, the most studied type of meditation in the West is a two-pointed meditation called mindfulness or insight meditation. Mindfulness uses the breath as the point of focus to quiet the mind and a non-judgmental awareness of your thoughts when the mind wanders. The funny thing about the mind is that it also has a mind of its own. In other words, the mind wanders before we know it has wandered. This is sometimes called monkey mind. Like a monkey that jumps indiscriminately from tree to tree, the mind jumps indiscriminately from idea to idea, often focusing on negative concerns. Unlike one-pointed meditation where you simply bring the mind back to the mantra when you discover it's wandered, in mindfulness, you observe the new thought non-judgmentally rather than ignoring it. Mindfulness uses the breath as the point of focus and views thoughts that arise with a state of non-judgmental awareness, being fully present to the myriad of physical and emotional feelings while not being impacted by them. A metaphor for meditation and mind is a rip current. When the ocean tide comes in, the beach quickly becomes saturated with water. The excess water needs a place to go, so it begins to spill back into the incoming ocean by creating a narrow current going against the larger tide. The best of swimmers who get caught in a rip current will drown if they become overwhelmed by fear and fight against the force of water. However, if they swim parallel to the beach, they eventually come out of the current and can once again swim ashore with the tide. Physical and emotional pain often make us fight against them, consuming us in their power. But if we simply float with it, non-judgmentally observing its impact, it eventually dissipates and allows us to be free from its grip of fear and suffering. In the beginning of mindfulness practice, the focus is only on the breath. Gently bringing your mind back to breath when you notice it has wandered. As you grow in the practice, you learn methods of body scanning, using the sensations of the body to strengthen the practice of non-judgmental awareness. With more practice, the mind often expands beyond the narrow focus of breath to incorporate feelings and sensations, and eventually streams of consciousness opening to other phenomena. In mindfulness, thoughts and sensations of the body become the teacher. A holistic view of the mind-body connection is that the body feels while the mind attributes feelings. In other words, what we feel translates into how we are feeling, and in doing that doubles the suffering. With mindfulness, you do not try to avoid the thought or feeling, but simply observe non-judgmentally, which in turn diminishes its power. Then you gently guide the mind back to the breath. Jon Kabat-Zinn is the best-known Western teacher of mindfulness and the founder of the Mindfulness-Based Stress Reduction Program, MBSR, at University of Massachusetts Medical Center. Over 30 years of research and meditation has shown, among other things, that it can help lower blood pressure, increase the immune response, and alleviate pain, or at least help people tolerate it better. Kabat-Zinn's Western model of mindfulness expanded the traditional sitting technique to walking meditation, non-judgmentally observing physical sensations of movement. There are many books and tapes on mindfulness as well as online videos. Like any practice, it is best understood by attending workshops and classes by trained clinicians, but the simplicity makes it possible to experiment on one's own. At this time, I'd like to take a moment to tell you about Cancer Care Services. At Cancer Care, along with these Connect Education workshops, we provide fact sheets and publications, including a relaxation fact sheet that can teach a simple three-breath exercise to de-escalate stress. We also have limited financial assistance for transportation to treatment, as well as referrals to other organizations and resources that might address your needs. Cancer Care is a unique oncology organization that provides individual and telephone counseling by oncology social workers. We also have regional face-to-face groups and national telephone and online support groups for patients and those who care about them. Most important at Cancer Care, we provide the opportunity to speak with an oncology social worker who can help you identify people and resources in your community, as well as a professional to talk with about the emotional impact and concerns of a cancer diagnosis. Cancer Care has been around for 70 years, and all our services are free. To many, support groups, social supports, and information to address practical and emotional issues go a long way in helping to confront the difficult challenge of cancer. Daunting as they are, with help, they are never impossible. You can speak to a social worker by calling our HOPE line at 1-800-813-HOPE. And I do wish all of you the best in your treatment and care. Thank you.
Oh, thank you very much, Rick. That was wonderful and a lot of really helpful ideas for everybody on the call today in terms of really being able to use the meditation to cope, and excellent. I'm sure there'll be questions for you during the Q&A as well. And now we do have time for questions. We actually have a lot of time for questions. And I'm going to ask Stephanie to bring all of our speakers on board. And Stephanie, if you would explain to everybody how to queue up for questions. And we'll take as many of your questions as possible.
Thank you. Ladies and gentlemen, if you'd like to ask a question, please press star then one on your touchtone telephone. If your question has been answered and you wish to remove yourself from the queue, you may press the pound key. Those of you on the web may submit questions by clicking Ask a Question. Again, please press star then one on your touchtone telephone to ask a question.
So I have a question for one of our online participants, actually. And so the first question is the first question is, my question is concerning the progression of M, ET to MF while being JAK positive. Does the scarring over time exist in early ET, and can anything be done to inhibit this? Thank you. Dr. Gottlieb, could you address that?
So the question, just to clarify, the patient has ET and it's progressed to myelofibrosis, or anything due to slow down or block the progression of ET to myelofibrosis? Is that the question?
Yes.
Okay. So ET, and just to expand upon what ET is essential thrombocythemia. It is a type of myeloproliferative neoplasm. It is a condition where the bone marrow on its own is making too many platelets. And again, platelets are the cells that help clot the blood. And the problem with ET is because there are too many platelets that are made, patients may be predisposed to clotting and actually in some cases to bleeding. If you look at various studies, the life expectancy of a patient with ET is either very similar to or slightly below that of an age-matched individual who is otherwise healthy. So the life expectancy of an ET patient overall is fairly good. The progression rate, or the prevalence of ET going to myelofibrosis over decades, is about 5 to 10%, and so it is very low. If you take polycythemia vera, for example, it's a little bit higher, perhaps 10 to 20%. To get back to the question, is there something that can halt or block the progression of ET to myelofibrosis? And my response to that is, currently in 2014, there's not a specific medical therapy that we know of that can slow down the progression of ET to myelofibrosis, although, again, I mentioned that the rate of progression is quite low. For patients who just have ET, we don't offer or typically recommend bone marrow transplantation for such patients. But for patients with ET who have subsequently progressed to myelofibrosis, transplant is an option, particularly for patients with myelofibrosis who are of higher risk and perhaps of relatively lower age and have a suitable donor, and their activity level or overall health is fairly good. Such patients, a proportion of them can be cured, but the relative risk and benefits of a transplant for that particular patient and their overall health profile needs to be discussed in detail with the bone marrow transplant physician. But I want to reiterate that the rate of progression from ET to myelofibrosis is low. Life expectancy of ET patients is relatively good, but we do not have a medical therapy in hand yet, including JAK inhibitors that show any data for slowing progression.
Awesome. Thank you very much. And our next question, Stephanie?
Our next question comes from Denise T. Your line is open.
Hi. My question is for Dr. Gottlieb, and I guess it's two parts. For someone or patients transitioning from polycythemia to myelofibrosis, have you seen muscular fasciculations? And also, is there much experience with Jakafi at that level, not high risk or intermediate myelofibrosis, but low risk?
Well, thank you, Denise, for those questions. Dr. Gottlieb.
Thank you. So there are two questions. The first regarding muscular fasciculations. So this is kind of twitching of the muscles. That is not something that specifically comes to mind as a PV-specific symptom. And so we do hear in myelofibrosis patients and PV and ET patients that there can be various symptoms. And particularly in patients with myelofibrosis, we do hear of muscle or bone pain. And that is certainly a symptom that has a fair degree of high prevalence in patients with myelofibrosis. In PV, it would be a less common symptom or side effect. So what I would just say is that just because a patient has PV or myelofibrosis, there may be many reasons for muscle symptoms, including fasciculations, and I think it would be incumbent upon the patient to see or start with their primary care physician to make sure there are other reasons that are ruled out, including even simple chemistry or metabolic disturbances. And the second question is, what about the use of JAK inhibitors in PV, for example? And low-risk myelofibrosis. Well, there are data with the JAK inhibitor ruxolitinib or Jakafi in patients with PV. This was published by Dr. Verstovsek and colleagues from MD Anderson Cancer Center in the fall of 2013. And PV is a disease that is characterized by, again, high red blood cell counts. These are patients who are managed with aspirin to reduce the chance of blood clots, with phlebotomy to reduce the red blood cell count to reduce the chance of blood clots. And in patients who are at relatively higher risk for future blood clots, we use typically some form of gentle chemotherapy like hydroxyurea to get the blood counts down to reduce the chance of clots. In this recent study published by Dr. Verstovsek and colleagues with the use of Jakafi or ruxolitinib, it was in patients specifically who were resistant to or intolerant of hydroxyurea. In these patients, the drug was able to eliminate in almost all patients the need for phlebotomy. It helped in a significant proportion of patients to reduce their spleen size. It also alleviated many of their symptoms, and it controlled their blood counts. So there is clearly activity with Jakafi, ruxolitinib, in patients with PV who are resistant or intolerant of hydroxyurea. The drug has not been tested to a large degree in patients with low-risk myelofibrosis. I suspect that over time that we'll see more and more data emerge from these patients. The issue is these patients with low-risk myelofibrosis often have few symptoms, but it may be a useful drug for patients with lower-risk myelofibrosis who do have symptoms or a spleen that is bothersome to them. Again, the data will need to emerge over time to analyze whether it's useful for such patients.
Thank you very much. Excellent. And our next question, Stephanie?
Our next question comes from Deborah P. Your line is open.
Yes. My question is, I have non-Hodgkin's lymphoma, and I have a lot of abdominal bloating symptoms. Are there any specific exercises that might help people like myself reduce the bloating and be more comfortable?
Thank you for that question, Deborah. I'm just going to ask Dr. Gottlieb to comment on stomach bloating, and then Donna address the exercises and things like that. Dr. Gottlieb, can you just address the bloating?
So just to clarify, you said you have non-Hodgkin's lymphoma. Do you also have a myeloproliferative neoplasm such as PV, ET, or myelofibrosis as a secondary disease?
No, I don't.
Okay. Well, let me just say that it's always hard to know specifically why there's abdominal bloating. I think that generally speaking, one needs to ask simple questions like, for example, are you receiving therapy right now? Were you recently diagnosed? Can you give me just briefly a sense of where you are in your treatment, or have you received treatment long ago, or is this a new diagnosis?
I'm in a watch and wait phase with no treatment having been administered.
Okay.
And you were diagnosed when, Deborah?
August of 2011.
Okay. So my response to that would be, I think that once you start with a broad approach with a general medicine workup and see whether, for example, there are simple things just as constipation, and I'm not saying you have constipation, but just simple things to rule out, such as constipation causing bloating. If one wants to be more specific to the non-Hodgkin's lymphoma, the issue is whether there's any large lymph nodes within the belly that are somehow impinging on the colon or are causing GI distress or bloating. That would be a very useful start. And also just to get a basic complete blood count and chemistries and liver test, and to see whether that would guide future directions of workup. And there may or may not also be a need to do imaging, and that, again, depends on your symptoms, your labs, and that can be started with your internal medicine doctor and, if needed, a referral to your medical oncologist.
Excellent. Thank you. And then in terms of just exercise, Donna, do you want to comment on that in terms of conjunction with the healthcare team?
One I could just add, too, is if all those other things become okay, then you really have to look at your diet and see what your – because there are certain things that might be just irritating you for the bloating. And then what if you have good peristalsis and good movement and everything is moving really well, then some gentle exercises like may do the trick. Not necessarily crunching or anything like that because you don't know what's going on in there, but just so put yourself on a walking program and so just, this is a flexibility exercise. But first you really need to find out the reason and the cause of the bloating.
Excellent. So, Deborah, most importantly is to schedule an appointment with your doctor or your healthcare team as soon as possible so they can assess that and then to kind of also let them know that you would like to entertain some exercise and where does that fit in. But they first probably want to find out because they're about the bloating. And Dr. Godley, could you comment on bloating? Because it does happen for people for many different reasons. In this context, it happens for very specific reasons. But can you just in general comment on that symptom of bloating or...
Yeah, bloating, again, it can be due to many causes. And I would just say that in the context of whether it be non-Hodgkin's lymphoma or specifically patients with myeloproliferative neoplasms, one should take a very broad approach first and not to necessarily hone in on one idea as the cause of bloating. And as has been mentioned, it can be due to the underlying disease. It can be due to diet. It can be due to issues about constipation. It can be due to other issues. And so a broad approach with an internist, getting the involved medical team, such as a subspecialist like the oncologist, as it relates to myeloproliferative neoplasms, and specifically patients with large spleens like myelofibrosis, the large spleen can cause a lot of abdominal discomfort, some cases bloating, and the early satiety or early fullness when one eats. And so there can be one cause, there can be multiple causes. It really is incumbent upon the patient to be an advocate for themselves and make sure that the question tries to get solved as much as possible. And it may require lab work, imaging, or other diagnostic tests. So bloating is a very kind of nonspecific term, and there can be many causes. And so if it's chronic enough and bothersome enough, then someone really needs to spend time with you to sort this out because it's a quality of life issue.
And there's another question from one of our online participants wondering if any vitamins, aspirin, or other over-the-counter medications might cause some degree of toxicity or more damage to bone marrow in patients with MPN. Dr. Gottlieb?
So aspirin or vitamins, well, what I would say is that low-dose aspirin, 81 to 100 milligrams daily, is the cornerstone of therapy for patients with polycythemia vera and essential thrombocythemia. It's recommended, again, to reduce blood clots or future blood clots. What I would say is that if someone has a history of ulcers or is on other anticoagulants for other reasons, that is blood thinners, one always has to weigh the risk and benefits of using aspirin. And so that is, again, a visit and discussion with one's doctor. But it is really a core component of therapy and should be used whether you're low risk or high risk in order to reduce future risk of blood clots and PV and ET. But, again, keeping mindful what are potential contraindications. Now, there are some potential vitamins or herbs that can affect platelet function, and platelets, again, are the cells that help clot the blood. So one can imagine that if one has low platelets in these MPNs or platelets that don't work very well because the platelets sometimes don't work very well, they're just not lower in number, there are some vitamin and herbs that actually can affect platelet function and cause more bleeding in patients. So that is, again, a discussion with the general medicine doctor or, more specifically, the hematologist or oncologist. And the hematologist or oncologist can review the medicine list and see whether there are any profiles of those drugs that can interact with your other medicines, like aspirin, because, generally speaking, patients with MPNs can have high risk of bleeding or clotting. And so you want to make sure that you're not tipping it, particularly to the bleeding side, with medicines that interact.
Awesome. Thank you so much. And then there is a question about exercise. For Donna, what blood counts are not safe to exercise, and what warning signs do you tell patients to watch for during or after exercise? So I guess the blood count, I don't know, Dr. Gottlieb, if you want to address that, are there blood counts that make it not safe to exercise?
Well, what I would say just generally about that is that there are patients with MPNs that over time, particularly, again, myelofibrosis, the platelet count can become very low. And what I mean by low is at least below 50,000, but the risk of bleeding goes up, particularly when the platelets are below 10 to 20,000. And so one can imagine if the platelets are that low, or again, the platelets don't work very well, they don't help, they don't clot very well, that if one is engaging in weight-bearing exercises with moderate to heavy weights, that could lead to more bruising or perhaps even bleeding. Mm-hmm. So one has to be careful in that regard.
So with that in mind, then, Donna,
one of the things you would do is you would not use heavy weights for the intensity, but you would use it for a lightweight for just the flexibility, and that you would really just monitor yourself very closely that after any kind of exercise that you don't have any excessive bruising, or that you don't have any pain anywhere because of the, you know, with the MPN and the many red cells and the many platelets that cause clots as well. So it's really a watch kind of situation that you really have to be careful, and that so that any exercise you do, one is if it's too low, you want to make sure that you're not bruising too much and you don't want to be too vigorous. And on the other side, you want to make sure that you're not too vigorous and you don't get a clot. I mean, it's very difficult, tenuous, and that's where you need sort of someone to help you design a program.
And I should just add that, you know, whether you're young or old, and if you do have a large spleen, you know, infrequently, but at a real potential risk, the spleen is large, and it is at some risk of trauma and having complications of what we call splenic infarct or rupturing the spleen. Again, this isn't a situation where the spleen is very large, so you would want to avoid contact sports or the activities where you're in a situation where the spleen is at risk for major trauma.
Mm-hmm. Well, thank you. And I've got a question actually for Rick Dickens in terms of meditation. The question it really has to do with, how often can someone do that, and when are some good times to do that in terms of coping?
Well, meditation can be done anytime, and the three breath exercise is kind of an introduction to certain types of meditation. It doesn't have to be three breaths. It can go on for 20 minutes or 30 minutes. As I said in our fact sheet, which you can find, it's a very simple exercise using the diaphragm to breathe. And different practices, if you practice with a teacher, will, as I mentioned, transcendental meditation traditionally will ask you to do 20 minutes in the morning and 20 minutes in the evening. Some different forms of mindfulness will do much more extended meditation periods or recommend them. Within the context of that, and I've spoken around the country at many conferences about these sort of techniques to people, I always say if you do it once, give yourself credit for it. If you do it more than once, enjoy whatever you get out of it. Without a doubt, if you want to, if it's beginning to help you and you want to learn it more, then learning it with a teacher and doing it more regularly, like anything, you will get more benefits out of it, and it will become a regular practice with a ritual of when and where you will do it. Mindfulness in the West, if you do get some training, and you really kind of need this to do this on the street or in your car or such, because you're not really visualizing or doing anything. You are just kind of very much focused. And as I said, mindfulness in the West, there are walking and moving meditations as well, which can be done at any time. What I guess I'm saying ultimately is don't set a barrier to yourself, which often becomes the fact that if somebody says you have to do it 20 minutes and you begin to not do it, we begin to think we're not doing it right and it's not worth our while. What I always say is learning a practice and trying it, give yourself credit for however little or however much you do it. And if you could do it more consistently and study with a teacher, it will become a much more valid practice in your well-being.
Thank you. And Dr. Gottlieb, anything about the breathing that would be anything to be aware of with MPNs or anything like that?
Well, what I would say is that patients with myelofibrosis who do progress, their spleen can get larger and larger in size. And patients often complain that they have more trouble breathing because it becomes more difficult for them to take large breaths because the large spleen is making it difficult for the diaphragm to increase. and accommodate large breaths. So they may complain of shortness of breath in that regard. They may complain of the fact that when they try to lean over and do any activity or tie their shoes, it's harder to breathe because, again, the spleen is impinging upon the diaphragm. And so the other issue is that sometimes the large spleen can cause issues with what we refer to as pulmonary hypertension, and can cause changes in the lung that also impact good pulmonary health and breathing and lung function. And so in that regard, if a patient can get on a therapy, whether it be a JAK inhibitor or something else that can shrink the spleen, that also may actually alleviate some of the breathing issues in our patients.
And Carolyn, I just want to say too, and Dr. Gottlieb, and appreciate that when I do this, and most of my presentations are to cancer patients with metastatic lung disease or bone mets or things like that, or gastric cancers, I always say this should not be painful. The breathing process should not be painful. We are always breathing all the time. It's just that how do you use it as a point of focus, and as has been said there, how do you maximize it without creating problems and or making it painful? That should never be part of it, and if there is any discomfort or pain, then you really have to look at the breathing process.
Excellent. And thank you. You know, we really have the multidisciplinary team today, all different teams represented here, and I have to say that one message we want to give you very strongly is that you've heard information today, but before you implement anything, certainly go back to your own treating physicians. I think we've heard that over and over again. And ask them, you know, check with them. If you have a symptom, you know, check that out with your doctors. So if you all call your doctors after today's program, it's okay, because indeed those are good questions to ask them, and they would want you to do that. Is that correct, Dr. Gottlieb, if you had a question?
I completely agree. Be your best advocate and always be on the safe side of asking questions to make sure that your symptoms or signs are addressed.
And I want to thank all of our speakers today. You've been extraordinary. It's a great, great team here. And all of you also are a great team, that you've been listening to this program and asked us really terrific questions. And I want to thank you all for that as well. I want to remind you that this is 1 hour program, and that in planning a program like this, we know that you have many needs that go far beyond the scope of 1 hour. And with that in mind, I do want to again remind you that we don't want anyone to actually feel that you're alone when this program ends. We want you to know that you're now part of the cancer care community, and that you can call us at any time, and you have our telephone number and all your materials, but I will say it again, 1-800-813-HOPE, and please do call us. We have a HOPE line. People call us, and we have an oncology social work staff to address your questions. I want to thank you all for your participation today. I want to remind you that this is part three, and there is actually a part four of this program, and part four is going to focus on the challenge of MPN in the workplace, how to communicate with your employer. So that's another program, and we have many more. There'll be many more coming up, so please do stay tuned, and thank you all for participating today. And I want to wish you all a very fine day.
Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for your participation. This concludes the workshop. You may now disconnect, and everyone, have a great day.